Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did President Nixon have in the foiled burglary at Democratic National Committee headquarters in 1972 and the cover-up that followed? The scandal resulted in Nixon's resignation from office 40 years ago this week. The subsequent pardon by President Ford officially laid Nixon's case to rest, but vexing questions have remained for decades about just how close the disgraced president was to the illegal events that imploded his administration. John W. Dean served as legal counsel to President Richard M. Nixon and pled guilty to a single felony count of conspiracy to obstruct justice for his early role in the cover-up. But Dean's frank testimony before Congress was influential in the president's decision to resign, and over the past several years, Dean has worked to uncover the remaining secrets about Nixon's role in the events of the early 70s. He writes about what he learned in his new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean is in town to speak this evening at Highland Park United Methodist Church, and we're delighted he could make time for us. John, welcome to Think.
Pleasure.
I have to tell you, I was astonished to learn that after all these years, you were the guy who decided to go and listen to these tapes. Historians had not listened or transcribed them.
Amazing that that had not happened. When my editor and I were talking, and he said, do you have any questions that you might want to answer? I said, yeah, a couple. I'd like to know how somebody as savvy as Richard Nixon could let his presidency just implode based on a bungled burglary. I really, you know, I was there. I was at the White House. I would, in the late stages, have some dealings with the president on it. But I just, I've always been curious, and knowing the fact that he was recording all that, I thought the answers are undoubtedly there. So what I did is I first of all, tried to see what was available, and I realized nobody had cataloged all the Watergate conversations. The archives, and bless them, because they have done remarkable work. In fact, I dedicate the book to them for their unsung toiling on these very difficult tapes, often to catalog them and prepare a subject log where they'll say the name of the speaker and then the gist of the conversation. They do not prepare transcripts. So at that point, I had to do it manually, and it took about 6 to 8 months to go through and just pull out all the Watergate conversations. Nobody had done that. There was no listing or anywhere. So I found there were roughly 1,000 conversations. I then looked to see how many had been transcribed. To my amazement, there were partial transcripts of about 400 conversations. That left 600 that I don't think anybody outside of the archives themselves had ever even listened to. So I, when I looked at the partial transcripts, I realized that often the parts that were missing, often done for space and other reasons, or the prosecutors were doing them for their own purpose, were really telling to, if you wanted to understand the full story, they'd left out those parts. So I took on the a year into the project, and had I known, I might not have started the project because it was massive. And I got graduate students who were working in the area of archival science to help me, and found one woman who was a former legal secretary, and she was wonderful. She did 500 of these conversations herself. Conversation can run from under a minute, and many of them, and most of them, run for substantially longer period of time. Some of them run hours upon hours. So it was a huge task. I raced right down to 90 days before publication. I still had the first drafts being prepared by my transcribers. So it was, and that was took 4 years to get there. So it was a big assignment, and I can't really explain why historians ignored them. Cannot.
Can you help me understand why President Nixon made these tapes? Because they seem like a liability for any president that undertook something like this.
Probably any president that undertook anything to keep this kind of record. What happened is there was a system at the White House when I first went there where either staff who was in the meeting or staff was called into the meeting to prepare notes of the meeting for historical purposes and But most importantly, if it was an outsider and the president made a decision, he didn't want someone going out and saying something he hadn't said. So there's a third party who often wasn't really involved making the notes, very low-key, and not it just looked natural to have that person in there. But that system broke down. It didn't work well. It got people like Henry Kissinger got way, you know, months behind on their notes and trying to reconstruct what had happened. So Haldeman realized, as chief of staff, that this system isn't good. Nixon wants a really good history, and he wants the protection of knowing that somebody's not going to walk out of the Oval Office and say he said something he didn't say. So he said that he recommended to the president that we start recording like Lyndon Johnson had. And when they actually got around to putting the system in, they decided the Johnson system wouldn't work. He had a switch underneath his desk that he could hit, or he actually just shouted at the secretaries in the outer office.
Turn it on.
Yeah, you got it. And they just thought Nixon wouldn't be good at that. And there was the technology had become available to have voice-activated recordings. And they tied it in with what they call the presidential locator system, where the president wears a little device on him that sends out a signal to where he is. It's picked up by the Secret Service Command Center. The Secret Service were the only people who knew about this, plus the president and Bob Haldeman and two of his aides, Larry Higbee and Alexander Butterfield.
Almost like a proto-GPS back in 1971?
It's put there. The conversation occurs in January of 71. They install them in February of 71. Mm-hmm. But they had, as I say, since January 20th of 69, they'd had this memo system that had shown itself not to work. So the way it was set up, only if Nixon was in the room and they had the Oval Office room set to record, they had his executive office building, suite of offices where they would record, but the president had to be there for the voice activation system to work. So if the cleaning crew's in there in talking, that won't activate the system. It had to be tied in with the locator system. I think it's clear from the number of tapes I've listened to that Nixon forgets most of the time he's being recorded. Haldeman often forgets, but there are times they clearly do remember. In fact, I cite some conversations where you can just see what's happened. They're performing. There are others where they catch themselves saying something they wish they hadn't said, and they will, for example, at one point in one conversation in April, Nixon is saying to Haldeman, well, I know you're involved in the cover-up. I know Ehrlichman's involved in the cover-up. I know I'm involved in the cover-up. And then he just... Two beats later, he pauses and says, I'm not involved in the cover-up. It's just pure doublespeak.
Okay, so President Nixon has been described by his critics and even some of his defenders alike as being quite paranoid. Is that a fair characterization?
I think there is certainly an element of that. He is a very complex person. He's a great character. He can carry a story wonderfully because of his language, because of his style. He's constantly surprises in what he'll say and how he'll react. And to be paranoid is one of the reactions that he will frequently evidence. He's deeply worried when he realizes he has to remove Haldeman, Ehrlichman, myself, and what have you. That will haunt him. And so he gets highly manipulative, and he dissembles telling different stories to different people. He's pretty good at this, actually. He can keep his lies straight to a degree, but it becomes patent to the reader what's going on.
Before things went south, what was he like to work for?
Well, with different people, he is a very different person. He seems to have something of a politician's nature, where he tries to identify and get on the same wavelength that he perceives with that person. Somebody like Chuck Colson, who was his so-called hatchet man, would bring out the darkest in him, and they would just have some really nasty conversations. To a degree, that would happen with Bob Haldeman, too, his chief of staff. With John Ehrlichman, he gets up on a little higher plane. With me, for some reason, he's on a very high plane, as he was with, say, his speechwriter, Ray Price. And so different staff see him differently, and only those like Haldeman that go into different meetings and across a wide spectrum. Another thing, you know, in queuing up these tapes, and all the personal material has been removed, as well as national security matters, classified information, but occasionally in queuing them up to get to the Watergate conversations, I noticed there would be conversations that related to government with his family, and that would otherwise be personal material, but because they were talking about government issues, he has a totally different relationship with his family. I'm sure they were shocked when they heard some of this. He has a lovely relationship, in fact, with his two daughters. It's a nice father-daughter relationship and conversations. When he thinks he's got a peace in Vietnam in 73, he doesn't call Henry Kissinger. He calls Pat Nixon, and he has this lovely conversation with him. And she, you know, she says, "Oh, Dick, I know what a relief this is." And his public relationship with his wife was always looked strained. His private relationship is lovely.
You were quite young when you went to work in the White House.
Early 30s.
Former employers, bosses had said to you, not a good idea.
Exactly. I had worked at the Department of Justice, and both the Attorney General, John Mitchell, who had been Nixon's campaign manager and was very close with the president, and my immediate superior, the Deputy Attorney General, Dick Kleindienst, when I told them that I had been asked if I would like to come over to the White House and be White House counsel, because John Ehrlichman was going to become assistant to the president for domestic affairs, they said, "Don't do it." They said, "I won't use the expletives that one used to describe why they thought not." But they both said, "Well, you're going to go higher in the Department of Justice." I was about the number 13th man still at a very young age. John Mitchell said to me, he said, "John, I wouldn't blame you for going. I can understand why you'd want that on your resume at this, you know, at your age. It's a wonderful opportunity." And he said, "Don't push it. Nixon will find you eventually." And that's actually what happened. It took a couple of years and it was a real disaster. And he finds me, and he's actually quite flattering behind my back.
What made you decide to take the job?
To take the job? A combination of things. I had an image of who Richard Nixon was. He turned out to be a little different when I actually got to know him, but that was after being there a couple of years. And I think that's true of most of the White House staff. They worked for the image of who they thought Nixon was, and not we didn't really know him. And he was very good at keeping himself shielded from his staff, in a sense, of finding out who he really was. But that's one of the jobs I thought this book would serve, to let us see who this man really was. Anyway, so that there was the attraction. When I had gone into government, I had made a friend of mine who I talked to about it, Senator Barry Goldwater. His son and I were roommates in school. And I didn't ever ask the senator to help me get a job, but I told him I was going to take a job in government. And he said, "John, you got to promise me one thing, and on a handshake, you got to look me in the eye and tell me you won't stay in government more than 5 years." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I've seen too many good men just go to waste here, and I don't think you should." I made that promise, and I was going to honor it.
My guest is John W. Dean. He served as legal counsel to President Richard M. Nixon and is author of the new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. He's in town to speak this evening at Highland Park United Methodist Church. We will get into a discussion of what Nixon knew and when he knew it after the break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John W. Dean, who served as legal counsel to President Richard M. Nixon. He's in town to speak this evening at Highland Park United Methodist Church about his new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John, before we get into what President Nixon knew and when he knew it, it's been 40 years since the resignation. I think it's safe to say that listeners under their mid-50s probably have no firsthand memories of seeing this in the news. For folks like that, for whom this is history, can you remind us of what was at stake in the Watergate break-in, what the advantage was thought to be by the people who planned this of breaking into DNC headquarters?
A lot packed into that question.
Yeah.
I really wrote the book for two audiences, those who lived through it and those who had no clue what it was all about. So I assume that it works for both readers. And Watergate begins with a bungled burglary at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C., where they had an office, hotel, apartment complex. And the Democratic National Committee had its offices there. The break-in, which was engineered by a fellow by the name of G. Gordon Liddy. Liddy has sort of in years since portrayed himself as a James Bond type character.
It's clear here that you don't see him that way.
I don't see him that way, and history doesn't see him that way. He bungles things a lot. Anyway, his team gets arrested in the Democratic National Committee. That gives the name Watergate to Watergate because of the location. And what it does, it later reveals other activities of the Nixon administration to where we today have a definition in most dictionaries that describe Watergate as abuse of high office occurring for political purposes during the presidency of Richard Nixon. And that's everything from campaign dirty tricks to abuses of government power. It ranges a wide gamut. When he is ultimately impeached, the bill of impeachment is very broad. It's obstructing justice, preventing engineering a cover-up. It's also misusing government resources for political purposes and things of this nature. So it's a complex scandal. It was a protracted scandal for those who lived through it. And it's a scandal that for a long time has had a shadow on American politics.
Why did the president's election team feel the need to get into this, given that he was in a very good position politically?
It was just not that. It was a whole atmosphere within the White House that Nixon himself condoned, where it was to the rough and tumble of politics. The president thought anything that had been done to him was fair game for him to do to others. Anything prior presidents had done was a precedent for him to do in his presidency, the big difference there being while it had been the exception to the rule with prior presidents for some of these things, Nixon made it sort of standard operating procedure. So we end up with what was called at the time an imperial presidency. And it's an aggressive exercise of presidential power, which is not well defined by the Constitution. And until the Congress started reining Nixon in, there was just nothing to stop him. He was going to go wherever he could go to accomplish what he wanted to, both politically and governmentally.
Watergate was not the first burglary planned.
No, it was not. There was one actually that comes up on the tapes also. When the Pentagon Papers were leaked in June of 71, the president initially, this is a study of the origins of the war in Vietnam prepared for Lyndon Johnson. And when it leaks in the New York Times, Nixon initially has a rather mild reaction to it. Henry Kissinger sort of stirs him up, warning him that, Mr. President, if we can't keep our secrets, I can't have effective negotiations in Paris in secret with the North Vietnamese to try to resolve that war. We'll not succeed in this China initiative we're planning for really the foundation of our foreign policy, and it would be the basis of his reelection campaign, if the Chinese won't trust us if we can't keep our secrets. Well, this got Nixon's attention, and he launches an attack after the leaker of that of those documents, Daniel Ellsberg. And that's when they'll form a unit in the White House, ultimately called the Plumbers, to investigate leaks that have few legal boundaries. But your question is, was he involved in other break-ins? He was, because at one point he will order a break-in on three different occasions into the vault at the Brookings Institute, which is the think tank in Washington. And I learn about it from a fellow who had been assigned to my office, who had worked in Ehrlichman's office when he was counsel, who said he had just come from Chuck Colson's office. And he said, Chuck had asked me to firebomb the Brookings Institute. I said, what? He said, he thinks I should firebomb the Brookings Institute. When the fire department is responding, it'll be a diversion, and I'm to send a safecracker in to break into the safe at the Brookings and get out the Pentagon Papers. I said, Jack, that is so absurd, I can't believe that anybody would suggest it. Not knowing where it had come from, I didn't know it had come from the president. I thought maybe, you know, Colson had cooked this up and he would argue with me. So I just decided to go right to the top over my, excuse me, my immediate superior for things like this was John Ehrlichman. So he was in San Clemente. I jumped on the next plane, flew out there, told him of this. I'd also pulled down the D.C. code and discovered that it was a capital crime in the District of Columbia if anybody died as a result of arson. And you start throwing firebombs around, and who knows what's going to happen. And I explained this to Ehrlichman, that it was craziness. And he simply picked up the phone, called Chuck Colson, and said, young counsel Dean is out here, doesn't think the Brookings plan is a very good one, Chuck, cancel it. Turned to me and said, anything else, counselor? I said, no, that'll handle it. It isn't until years later, when the tapes come out, that I learned the order for the break-in really came from Richard Nixon, who is at one point literally pounding on the desk saying, I want a break-in. I want it yesterday. Nobody's exercising. Nobody's following through. Colson was trying to implement the president's order when I stepped in. And as one of Ehrlichman's deputies later said, Bud Krogh, he said it was an incredibly bold act of me to interrupt this plan. But I thought it was insanity. It just made no sense. So as a result of that, I was told nothing of the Plumbers operation and didn't learn about it until I talked with Gordon Liddy after his men had been arrested in the Watergate, and he informed me, you should know that two of the men I used in the break-in to Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, another break-in, which the president didn't know about. In fact, I'm the first one that informs him about that. He says two of the men I used are now in the D.C. jail from this effort to break into the Watergate. So this is how the Watergate melds from the reelection committee with the White House. It's the same players who'd gotten themselves on the wrong side of the law repeatedly in these crazy schemes.
So you're convinced that Nixon did not order the break-in at the Watergate building on Democratic National Committee headquarters, but he had created a climate that made people think that this was something that would get the president's approval.
Exactly. And what's ironic is the night of the arrest at the Watergate, that their real mission was to go into George McGovern's headquarters. And if that had happened and they'd been arrested there, you can literally, excuse me, trace from Liddy right back to the president, because there is a tape where the president is instructing Haldeman to have intelligence gathered from McGovern. He says, put a plant in there, not a flower, a plant. And that could have a lot of meanings. It could be an electronic device. It could be a secretary. It could be a chauffeur.
Listening, paying attention to what was going on.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so Haldeman has one of his aides call Liddy into the White House and literally read him the instruction, change your your intelligence gathering from Muskie, who was the front, Senator Muskie was the front runner, to McGovern, who looked like he was then going to capture the Democratic nomination. And that's where they were headed the night they were arrested at the DNC. And as I say, it would have been a whole different problem had that occurred.
So tell us about how and when.
Incidentally, all these pieces that fit together, no one's had these until I went through all these tapes and put these, connected all these different dots so we could get a full picture of exactly what did happen. Because I, you know, 40 years after the fact, to just have smatterings of knowledge that had been plucked for investigative purposes is largely what historians have relied on, rather than actually listen to this remarkable primary source material, the likes of which we'll never have. No president is ever going to have voice-activated recordings again.
Can you understand every word, and can you always tell who's speaking in these conversations?
I can understand who's speaking because of my familiarity. That was one of the problems with the prosecutors. They did about 80 transcripts. 12 of them that were used in the trial are very good because clearly Haldeman and Ehrlichman corrected them. The rest are really highly defective. They were done, I learned, by FBI secretaries, and they didn't know who was speaking. Often they'll have Ron Ziegler speaking words that John Ehrlichman was speaking, or they get the parties confused. They'll confuse Haldeman and Ehrlichman. So I did all those over. The reason I did Stanley Cutler, the historian who did 320 conversations, I did his over because he has ellipses throughout just to compress material. I often found that the ellipses could be 20, 30 minutes and information that I thought was important. So I decided I had to do everything from the very beginning. And yes, you can understand them. What I was also able to do, that the first people who transcribed them, they had analog copies. I went into the archives and I was given 45 to 90 minute cassettes. They're 90 minute cassettes, but they would typically only use one side. And I found a device in the United Kingdom, in England, that you can put these cassettes into and plug it in with the right software into a computer. And in 5 minutes, I could digitize a 90-minute cassette. I could do both sides simultaneously. The archives people were salivating at my equipment, but they now
have... Seems like they should have that, doesn't it?
They have digitized now, mm-hmm. but they actually had better masters than I had. So their copies, and I actually have an Appendix C it's posted online. There's a URL for it in the book, and people can go online and listen to these tapes themselves. And they're pretty good, but they're still tough. They are very hard. The EOB is the worst. The telephone calls are the best. Some of those can be broadcast quality. Camp David and the Oval Office are fairly similar. It depends. If people are close enough to the microphones, then you can hear them pretty well. Nixon tended to sit back from his desk, and his are often, you have to listen very carefully. And the way you do this is playing them over and over and over.
All right. Tell us about the moment that President Nixon was told about what had happened at Watergate.
He learns... in Florida, because Liddy had used his partner in this was a fellow named Howard Hunt. Hunt was a retired CIA operative who was a consultant at the White House before he went with Liddy over at the Reelection Committee. They bonded and became fantasy friends, if you will. Because the men arrested in the Watergate were Cuban Americans from Miami, the Miami newspaper had a very brief front page, lower below the fold story. This is where Nixon, who had been in the Bahamas during that weekend, he comes back on Sunday and he looks at his Sunday paper and he notices this article about these Cuban Americans being arrested. They're wearing business suits. They have surgical gloves on. They have their pockets are stuffed with $100 bills, and he thinks it's a prank. Later that day, his friend Bebe Rebozo, who was very close to the Cuban community, assured him it was not a prank. These were not prankster-type people. They were people who'd been involved in the Bay of Pigs operation and had CIA connections, many of them. And they were, one was a respected Miami real estate broker. Another one was a salesman for him. And so Nixon calls Colson and even gets more bad news. And that is that a fellow by the name of James McCord, who had been the head of security at the reelection committee, Liddy had used as his, what he called his wire man to McCord's job at the CIA at Langley was to make sure there were no bugs there. But Liddy used him to plant the bugs at the DNC. When Nixon learns that, he throws an ashtray across the room. He tells Colson he's so angry. He walks that back later to have sort of a non-reaction. But I think the initial reaction was he immediately saw the implications of what was going on.
And his response in terms of defending himself and his reputation was what in those initial days?
In the initial days, the first thing that John Mitchell, who had everyone, we now, it's pretty clear to me that and to everybody else that Mitchell approved this because it wouldn't have happened otherwise. And his initial reaction is that Mitchell calls Haldeman at the White House. They clear a press release. It's a bogus press release. Haldeman knows it's bogus. Ehrlichman knows it's bogus. Mitchell knows it's bogus. And that's where the conspiracy to obstruct justice really starts, right at that point. But Nixon is told that Mitchell has advised the White House to stay away from this. 48 hours later, he changes his mind because he has had two of his aides debrief Gordon Liddy. And he's found that while Liddy worked at the White House, he engaged in this break-in at Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Howard Hunt had been doing phony cables to try to implicate President Kennedy in the killing or the murder of the president of South Vietnam. And there were just all kinds of what Mitchell would later call White House horrors. This changes Mitchell's mind. My first conversation post-arrest with Mitchell was I thought he might step forward and say, listen, this happened on my watch. I didn't directly authorize this. I indirectly did because I was one to collect intelligence and take blame for it and stand up, and it would be the end of it. After he has learned of the other problems, he does 180, and he's more worried about what the White House has done than he's done.
My guest is John W. Dean, who served as legal counsel to President Richard M. Nixon and is author of the new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. He's in town to speak this evening at Highland Park United Methodist Church. We will be taking your calls and emails after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're sitting this hour with former White House legal counsel John Dean. He's written a new book called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. He'll be speaking this evening at Highland Park United Methodist Church in Dallas. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Bert in Dallas. Hey, Bert.
Hi. Mr. Dean, I believe you said previously regarding that famous 18-minute gap that you didn't believe there was anything particularly damaging on that gap but that wasn't already revealed in other parts of the tape. Do you still hold that view, and how did that gap occur? And then quickly to another part, the tapes were just broadcast here recently, the new tapes, and Nixon's talking to you, I believe, about the $1 million that might be required for, I suppose it's hush money for the burglars and other expenses. But it wasn't clear what happened and if how much money was actually raised. And there's talk that some of that money came from Teamsters, the Teamsters Union.
Let me cut right to your first question first. The question on the 18.5-minute gap, I was pretty sure that people would raise that. It has been raised almost everywhere I've discussed this. There's an appendix that addresses this directly.
In great detail.
In great detail. It explains why it is not a terribly important issue. It became a media issue. And it explains in a note who could have done it. And explains also that Rosemary Woods, notwithstanding taking credit for doing it or thinking she had done it, it was mechanically impossible for her to do it. And it also, to me, the most important thing is what was erased. And it's very easy by following the timeline to realize what came up frequently that first week was talk of a cover-up. And this blew away his defense when he said he had no knowledge of cover-up until March 21st when I told him there was a cover-up and it was an obstruction of justice. This is what actually, to me, it was not terribly important because there are much worse things on these tapes that came up in my search of them. Everything from Nixon's suborning perjury of Jeb Magruder, who became the first key witness to make the cover-up work, to his selling an ambassadorship to personally raise money. I've connected all those dots. We know I've answered every question I ever had about Watergate and done it not with a series of transcripts where you have to dig it out, but rather in a narrative with dialogue drawn from the tapes. The money question kind of runs throughout. You'll find that Nixon knew about the money long before I had that money discussion with him on the 21st, where I told him it could cost $1 million, and he said, well, that's no problem. I know where we can get that. And I discover he goes out after our conversation is over. He talks to his secretary, Rosemary Woods. First, he's been raising money privately and selling an ambassadorship before then. And then afterwards, he talks to Rose Woods about their own very secret slush fund that only he and Rose Woods know about. And ask how much she has in that, and she tells him, I have about $400,000. So all those pieces are put together into a story, so it flows and you can follow it. And that's one of the reasons I did the book, to respond to people like yourself to see how it all fit together.
Is Rosemary Wood still alive?
No.
She died thinking that she erased the tapes.
She did.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Randy who asks, how close did the Nixon White House come to destroying the tapes?
Well, I found several conversations where the president instructs Haldeman to do just that. He's uncomfortable, and then Haldeman cautions him that these may have historic value. He said particularly issues like China, where you might have a different record than Henry Kissinger, and you wouldn't want Henry to write this history, but you need your own sources, and Nixon agrees with him. So he kind of backs down. Haldeman suggests they go to a system like Johnson had where there's a switch. This is a system that they had now tested because Ehrlichman had such a system in his office where he could hit a switch at his desk and record everybody in his office. And Nixon kind of likes that idea. Nothing happens, and Nixon raises the whole issue again and said, well, let's keep the national security stuff and get rid of the rest. Will you take care of that, Bob? And Haldeman says, sure, but never does. I think what happened is clear. Two things. First of all, he's not a lawyer, and I think he felt that these tapes might be used selectively, and they could take out what worked for them and make the rest disappear. The other thing is he gets totally consumed by Watergate, and he no longer has the ability where he could do that without clearly obstructing justice.
How did you go from advising the president in part on how to defend against what this scandal would look like to working with prosecutors?
I was very open with the with my colleagues, as becomes apparent from the tapes, in telling them that after I try to convince the president to end the cover-up, and I realize I have spent my last efforts because I haven't convinced him to do so. To the contrary, he still thinks the cover-up has to go on. He doesn't know how long, but he's aware of the problem. And I realized that he's also wanting me to write a bogus report about it, and I'm not willing to do that. I tell them I think I need to hire a lawyer, they think that's a good idea. In fact, I encourage them to do the same. I have, by that time, I had read the statutes right after the election. That's when I became convinced that what we were doing was wrong. And it occurs when Chuck Colson, who had brought Howard Hunt into the White House, records a call with Hunt within days after the election. And Colson is very pleased with this tape because he gets Hunt to admit that he didn't know in advance of the fact they're going to break in the Watergate, notwithstanding he was broadly involved in getting Jeb Magruder and John Mitchell to approve it. He told them to fish or cut bait, or he might use them, but he didn't. He didn't directly order the Watergate, and he claimed he didn't know their plan. So he gets Hunt to partially exonerate him. But what Hunt is really calling about is he wants more money. He's been paid, and every time he starts to raise this, Colson tries to cut him off, but doesn't. He keeps coming back to it and saying, you know, be ashamed to let this all fall apart for just a simple thing like money. And it's this conversation that makes me think, you know, this is a clear quid pro quo arrangement. These people aren't talking because they're getting paid. This isn't any sort of charitable payment to take care of their support and their attorney's fees. It's to keep them from talking. And so I got into the statutes, began reading them. I'm not a criminal lawyer. I had told Ehrlichman right after Liddy confessed to me what had happened. I had first told him I thought we ought to have a criminal lawyer on the White House staff. I said, I don't have any background in this. And I said, John, to my knowledge, you don't have any background. I said, no lawyers on my staff. We don't have any here in the White House. But he dismissed that. He didn't want it. In fact, I will have this problem with him constantly, even in conversations in front of the president where I'm arguing we're breaking the law. And he'll say, well, counsel here is reading statutes, but I don't think he's reading them correctly. Well, I was reading them very correctly. Haldeman, when I prepare a list of everybody I think in the White House who can be indicted, tells the president, recites sort of from memory what I had told him. It turned out everyone I was right, but he tells the president that just shows you how astray John Dean's thinking has gone, that we're all going to be indicted. Well, it was denial. It was rationalizations. There's, you know, what they were confusing was with motive, with intent. You can intend to commit a criminal act for a good reason, but it's still a criminal act. They didn't feel their motive was bad. In fact, I found a fascinating document in the in some of the documents I pulled from the Watergate prosecutor's office where they address this whole issue of how you deal with good motive involved in criminal activities. It doesn't eliminate the crime. It can affect sentencing. It can affect a jury. But it still doesn't make it a non-crime.
Was there any length to which those individuals that we've talked about would not have gone to protect the president had things not ended the way they did?
That's a fair question. In fact, it's a question that the prosecutors asked me fairly early. Nixon really gets very aggressive in putting the word out to try to destroy me when I break rank, particularly after Haldeman and Ehrlichman have left the White House. It becomes so severe, and the atmosphere is so poisoned that first the Senate Watergate Committee, Chief Counsel Sam Dash, and then the Watergate Special Prosecutor both recommend that I go in the Witness Protection Program. There's so many death threats out. And prudence counseled me to indeed do that, and I'm in that program for a year and a half. Until after Nixon has left office and the trial is over and what have you, and then it becomes something of a non-issue. So the what length would they go to? One of the most mild-mannered persons in the Nixon White House was speechwriter Ray Price. He was fairly progressive, known as the House liberal. He knew my situation. He knew I wasn't going to lie. And he said he had been in that situation, what he would have done was get a gun and go in a room and shoot himself in the head. I just couldn't see, given the kind of activities that Nixon was engaging in, that I should go kill myself so he can continue doing these kinds of activities. I thought the truth was the better solution. So that's what I did. I just stuck with the truth.
Do you watch House of Cards?
No, I don't. But I have promised. Bob Woodward's review of my book compares it to House of Cards and says it makes the House of Cards look very unsophisticated and mild. So when I was actually asked that question on Face the Nation, I said, well, I now have got to do a binge watch on House of Cards, so I look forward to doing that.
Maybe when the book tour is over, you can sit down. I want to know just personally how you got through those very stressful times 40 years ago and whether you imagined that 40 years hence people would still be really interested in this and it would still be something that would follow your name forever.
Well, you know, I was well aware of the fact that once this broke, and I'm well aware of the media, that once you get pigeonholed, you live in that pigeonhole forever. So I knew that I would always be identified with it. The way I got through it on a day-to-day basis, the short answer is scotch with a little ice. I, after that, stopped drinking and hadn't had a drink since sometime in the 70s. I just decided this isn't the way to solve any problem, but it did help ease the pain, and I was young, so my system could withstand it. The interest in it has surprised me. In fact, I have spoken here in Dallas recently to several legal groups because while working on this book, I realized I had some downtime while my transcribers were getting ahead of me so I could start writing. And at that time, I developed what they have continuing legal education requirements in various states. And we wrote the book of what not to do. And you can draw from that, and also right from my testimony emerged the ethics standards that now apply to all lawyers everywhere. And the American Bar Association got very serious about that post-Watergate, and they required that law schools teach ethics. They require a multi-state bar examination that every lawyer must take. And then there's this requirement in most states of a continuing legal education where they are exposed to ethical issues. Well, most CLEs are terribly boring. They're talking heads. They're dull. But here's some rather fascinating history. So in a highly visual program, a friend of mine, an attorney from Cleveland, and I started doing this, and it took off. We have no sales, no marketing, and we've done about 85 of these things. And there's just we have a long list of people who would still like us to do more of them, and I had to stop doing them to write the book. So there is an interest out there. And, you know, whether it'll in turn be reflected by sales of the book or not, I don't know, but there's certainly a lot of media interest as we approach this 40th anniversary of Watergate.
John W. Dean served as legal counsel to President Richard M. Nixon, and he's author of the new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. He's in town to speak tonight at Highland Park United Methodist Church in Dallas. John, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.